if I could start with again with your latest novel, which we also touched upon this during the discussion, that you are using this classic plot of equilibrium being disrupted by a mysterious stranger.
Yes, yes, yes.
Remember even Shakespeare or Mark Twain or my favorite film, Pasolini's Teorema.
Oh, my Lord. It's one of my favorite films, too.
Really?
Isn't it great?
It is. Yes, my, it's
yes.
My
I watch it every few years all
really?
Over again.
It's
that
brilliant.
One just slays me.
I'm
but
so
yes,
glad
yes.
To hear that. So why did you think this was a potent plot?
You know, you can argue that there are really only two stories. There's someone going on a journey, and there is a mysterious stranger arrives in your village, and every story is a variation on one of those two. My other novels have been structurally very ambitious. They've spanned different time periods, different locations, different characters. And this time I wanted to see what it would be like to write a more traditional novel, if the other novels have aspired to a kind of symphonic scale. This is more of a string quartet, and I think that as a sort of as a composer manquee, as somebody who would love to be able to write music if I could, I feel that you want to write symphonies and string quartets both.
Another important intertext, I would say, or seed or homage of is Thomas Mann's wonderful story, Death in
yes,
Venice.
Yes, yes.
Which replicates in many ways in your novel. It's a story about erotic longing for beauty, for youth, for something that stranger represents to the one that's longing. So if you could tell me why, do you think this narrative or this plot is still somewhat transgressive, still somewhat radical, and also the illusionary nature of this longing that we were discussing?
Oh yeah, I think there is something still transgressive about a man who is obsessed with a younger man. It still has power. It still feels wrong, and we are of course repelled by and attracted to things that feel wrong. And I was especially interested in writing about a heterosexual man who becomes sort of obsessed with not so much this boy as
just
what
like
this boy
Aschenbach.
Represents. Just like Aschenbach, yes. Though without giving away the ending, I don't leave Peter dead in a beach chair with a bad dye job. I had a different fate in mind for my character.
The sexual complexity or gender complexity even seems to be a reoccurring theme in your novels, of course. The Hours.
Yeah.
It's brilliant in that way, in many ways. First of all, for a male writer to be writing such a story on three complex female characters is remarkable. But also the relationship between Clarissa and Richard is also, you're addressing complexity of sexuality in a very skillful way, I thought. The same themes occurring in this novel. Do you think that the whole complexity of human desires, emotions, sexuality, or gender roles can ever be fully represented in life or in literature, moreover?
Well, I think we're more likely to do it in literature than we are in life. I think it is one of the jobs of a writer to complicate the world, to always insist that things are more complex than they appear to be on the surface. And yeah, I am very much interested in the complex and highly personal nature of sexuality. I feel that each of us has his or her own sexuality, and I try to be mindful of the fact that knowing whether somebody is officially gay or straight or bisexual tells you almost nothing about that person at all.
So you're being a little bit Foucauldian in that sense, that labeling, in a way, is a way of organizing and controlling when it comes to sexuality, particularly.
It's a way of organizing and controlling and distorting and oversimplifying. And I think we need, as human beings, to constantly rebel against any attempt to categorize us or or label us. And I think that one of the things that novels are meant to do is to help remind us that none of us fits any of the categories, and that we must never allow ourselves to think of ourselves as belonging to any particular group that can be summed up in a few words.
But why is society controlling sexuality then? What would you say?
You know, I ask myself that question as well. When the right wing in America is so adamantly opposed to equal rights for gay people, I don't really understand what the problem is. It's a bit of a mystery to me. I can only think that. Again, I can only speak for Americans, but there has to be somebody to be afraid of. There has to be somebody to target our hostility toward, and we are still very much afraid of people of color and of women. But it's no longer okay to express that disdain and fear. So it's still okay to say it about gay people. To say, okay, well, yeah, equal rights for women, equal rights for black and Hispanic people, even a lot of people who don't really believe that. But you can say, no equal rights for gays and get away with it. The gays are one of the last persecuted minorities, and that's ending. But it's taking long.
Yeah, it will end at some point.
It will end. It has to end. All persecutions eventually end. Some take longer than others.
To go back to another point that we touched upon briefly during the discussion, the question of ordinariness or triviality of our lives. So the main character in your latest novel comes to realize that he has to constantly somehow invent his triviality again and again. Mm-hmm. He has to innovate, mm-hmm. even mm-hmm. though it seems very trivial. And he also becomes aware of the illusionary nature of the allocyte, the non-conformity and the freedom. Was this also sort of conscious homage to Virginia Woolf again? Virginia Woolf, who is noted for her celebration of triviality of women's lives,
yes.
and finding strength and courage even in this triviality.
Yes, yes, yes. One of the things that I so love about Virginia Woolf is just what you say, her insistence that outwardly ordinary lives are anything but ordinary to those of us who are living them. We find our lives to be fascinating and of epic proportions. And Woolf came along with Flaubert, who was a little bit earlier, and Joyce, and said essentially, no, there is no such thing as an ordinary life. There are only inadequate ways of portraying the lives of the people of Earth. And to me, Woolf was especially heroic because she insisted not only on the importance of outwardly ordinary lives, but the importance of women's lives.
Such as is done brilliantly, Mrs. Dalloway. And here I come to the question that you've been asked a million times, I'm sure, and I apologize in advance, but The Hours.
Yeah.
How did you come up with the idea to write such a novel, and why Mrs. Dalloway?
It came in stages. Mrs. Dalloway was one of the first great books I read, and it changed my life. I had not imagined that it was possible to do with language what I saw Virginia Woolf doing in Mrs. Dalloway. Virginia Woolf was my first love, and it could have been Stendhal, it could have been Tolstoy. Somebody put a copy of Woolf into my 15-year-old hands, and so it was love forever. I was doomed from the get go. The Hours actually started out to be just a rewrite of Mrs. Dalloway. I wondered what Mrs. Dalloway would be like set in contemporary America, and that felt sort of like a conceit after a while. That felt like a rather thin idea for a novel.
So just one story.
Just one story. And then it grew the second story involving Virginia Woolf, and that still didn't feel like quite enough. And then it, as I wrote, sort of developed this third story about a woman named Laura Brown who is reading Mrs. Dalloway. And then it felt like something I could imagine writing. We had Virginia Woolf, the writer, Clarissa Dalloway, the character, and Laura Brown, the reader. We had a perfect triumvirate, and there I went.
And what did you think about the film adaptation?
I loved the film. This makes me one of the handful of writers who have ever had anything good to say about the film adaptations of their novels, but I thought they did a beautiful job.
And yet I read somewhere that the characters were nothing like you visualized them when you were writing the
novel. Oh, no, they can't be. They wouldn't be. I'm not picturing Nicole Kidman when I write Virginia Woolf or Meryl Streep when I write Clarissa Dalloway, but it is a remarkable thing to see actors of that caliber play characters you invented. I still can't quite believe it. It's been years.
But when we read a novel, we all visualize the characters. All of us do it differently. We all have our own.
Absolutely.
But then a film comes out, especially a successful film, Hollywood production, and these images kind of get cemented.
Yeah.
Now we have, like you say, Nicole Kidman and Julianne Moore and Meryl Streep. So do you think that's, in a way, that can be a little bit negative to the perception of the limits, the perception of the book?
Yeah. I think it is one of the problems of a film adaptation. You do once you've seen Meryl as Clarissa Dalloway, you're not really going to imagine your own Clarissa. It's why if I go to a movie that's adapted from a novel, I always try to read the novel first, and I recommend that if people can do it. And if you can't, there are worse things than having Meryl Streep in your mind. I can think of much worse fates.
Do you think it's possible to comment on a great work of art simply by just putting it in or allocating it in different time period? Did Mrs. Dalloway become more relevant because of the hours in our day and age?
Well, it certainly became more widely read. Once the movie of the hours came out, Mrs. Dalloway started appearing on bestseller lists. People were buying it all over the place, and that was enormously satisfying. So even if my book didn't do anything to re-examine Mrs. Dalloway, the fact that it brought Mrs. Dalloway sort of back into public awareness was enormously satisfying. And I felt like that was a sort of unambiguously good result of writing that book.
Just to go, and I have really a couple of more questions left. Go back to the question of gender and female characters. Now, complex female characters have been very rare historically in Western tradition.
Yeah.
The prose writing was always a male endeavor, and they were the authors. And women, as many feminists have noted, have been confined to the virgin whore, wife,
and then the
femme fatale categories.
Absolutely.
Now, there are some examples, of course, the hours being one of them, a very vivid example of breaking this pattern and really portraying female desires, their fears, the whole complexity of their emotional lives. Were you aware of this difficulty when you were writing? Especially I'm talking about the hours, of course.
Yeah. I mean, I am a man. You can probably tell from my voice. And whenever you move away from your own direct experience, you take a risk. But I like women, which seems like such an obvious thing to say, but I think a lot of the male novelists I read don't like women especially and are not that interested in them. I like women, and I'm enormously interested in them. And as I thought about and began to write about these women, I became ever more convinced that although there are considerable differences between the two sexes, there is a certain level of fundamental character that's not so different.
And a novel is able to express that.
Yes. I think in our souls we probably have no genders. And the novel is trying to scratch around its characters so deeply and insistently that we start to rub up against the people's souls.
On a slightly different issue that we were also discussing, the crisis of creativity or crisis of big ideas and commodification of art.
Mm-hmm.
The money people, as you say, dominating the art world now. I wonder, is it only the money people, or maybe this has to do with more general condition that the Western world is in right now? Why is it that two, three generations ago, it was still possible to write a major novel with major significance, make a good film, or come up with new cinematic language or style, or even philosophers were able to say something new and meaningful?
Whereas
that has become very rare, especially with philosophers. So some people say that it could be because we're living in post-modern era, gray era. We've made fun of all the grand narratives, of all the big issues, and now there is just no language, no way to move forward, and all we can do is go back to, say, Renaissance and then the ideas of beauty and love.
You know, I suspect that many generations in the past felt that it had all been done before and now there's no place further to go until some holy genius comes along and demonstrates that to be untrue. The world is certainly capable of recognizing its novelists. Look at all the fuss that's coming, that's risen up around the Jonathan Franzen novel, which is an ambitious novel. And I can tell you it's a big novel because I've been carrying it around all over Europe with me. I think that there is always hope. I think that art always moves forward, not as quickly as we might like it to. Sometimes not for a generation or two. But I was on a panel once with Norman Mailer about the death of the novel. And at one point toward the end, Norman leaned his great shaggy head forward and said, the novel will be at your funeral. And I think he was right about that.
You think it's still possible to be rebellious, to push the envelope, to after 1968, 1969? Is it still possible to...
Oh, sure. I think it's always possible. I think it would only be difficult if we lived in a perfect world. I mean, look at the political climate. Look at our consumer culture. There is so much to write about. I can't imagine we'll ever run out of the material necessary for epic
novels.
Should
a writer be rebellious and critical of societal or political?
If the novelist aren't going to be, who is? That's part of what we need novelists for.
Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Thank you.